Tonight, our 40-minute speaker is Jerome S. from Corona. Let's thank you.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Jerome, and I'm a very grateful and fortunate member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, it's an awesome time to be invited back. It wasn't always that way. You know, you're knocking at somebody's door, they say, shh, ain't nobody home. No. My sobriety date is June 6, 1973. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 25 years old, broke, busted, and couldn't be trusted. Toe up from the floor up. The lights was on and wasn't nobody home. I'm talking about I took those parents of mine through literal hell. My dad put me out of his house at 18 because I was incorrigible. He was tired of going upside that head. He was tired of arguing with me. And he sent me down at that kitchen table. He said, look, I just paid the mortgage. I bought food for the family. The utilities are paid for. We will be warm and we will have food. And he said, you have not contributed one dime to these endeavors. And it seemed like you can't go along with my program. He said, there's a dough. Let it hit you with a good large split you, and don't let it hit you on the way out. Oh, he was serious intervention. I grabbed my only suit from Zyler's and Zyler blue on blue pinstripe player suit and went to my chosen profession of being a hustler. Well, there's no hustlers in San Clemente tonight. I know that's not a job description in this area. My hustling capabilities consisted of stealing the newspapers out of the rack in front of the Greyhound bus station in downtown Los Angeles and selling them on Spring Street like I had a paper route. If that didn't go over too good and they harassed me off the bus depot's property, I sold whole blood every 58 days and plasma twice a week. Oh yeah, this is a deal to sell plasma. You have to lay down for a long time. And when I lay down selling plasma, I got time to think. And I'm thinking, this is blood money. You're not going to get drunk with blood money. This is seed money to come up. You're going to get up off this table after you get your juice and graham cracker. You're going to go buy you some decent clothes at the Goodwill. You're going to might work a couple of days at one of those day laborer places, passing out handbills early in the morning. Then you get you enough money, check into junior college, get you a trade. That's what I tell myself. Get myself a trade. Get me a little old job. Get wino sharp like I am tonight. Get me a pre-owned automobile. Pull up in front of the deacon's house. Get out. And put my hands on my hip and say, see, sucker, I told you I was going to be somebody. And get in my vehicle and roar off. That would be on the couch. But as soon as I get up, I remember reading something in Reader's Digest. A little red wine will build your blood back up. And I'm talking about I was looking like death sucking a soda cracker with a coat too long to be short and too short to be long. And so I moved in behind in the neighborhood so they could feel sorry for me. I got a plan at the hot dog stand. I'm living behind the hot dog stand in the neighborhood. And right next to the hot dog stand was Safeway supermarket. And I would panhandle in front of Safeway. And I catch the good sisters from the church that my father was a deacon at. And Sister Brown would be going in there to get her kids some milk. And I say, Sister Brown, you got 50 cents so I can get me something to eat? And, you know, I didn't look like I did when I was going to Sunday school there. And she would rush into the market, grab her purse, and run in for safety. And I say, look at this old. And when she came out, I didn't have those skills like, God bless you, have a good time, or have a good day. I cut Sister Brown out so bad, she'd be crying, and she'd call the deacon, my dad. I saw your son up there, Mr. Scott. And he looked so bad. He looked like he's about dead. And that would just tear at his heart and his pride and his ego. And he'll send one of my younger sisters to tell me to come back home. And he'll sit me at that kitchen table and he'll give me that fatherly talk. And I tell him, I say, Dad, I'm going to straighten up, fly right, turn over new leaf, take care of business. I'm going to check in school. I'm going to get me a job. And I ain't going to be hanging out with them tramps no more. Mad Dog, Pookie. And, and I did it. I checked into junior college, got me a county job as a librarian's assistant because, see, I'm not dumb. I'm just a little inconsistent. And I got that job. And I guess it was around Christmas vacation, that first semester in junior college. I was doing extremely well because I'm a bright student. Like I said, I'm not dumb. And I decided to go to an apartment, to a party, because this girl in class liked me. And me and my buddy Pookie, we was going to go to the dance. And we went up to Pookie's house and we was getting ready to go to the dance. I thought his dad was going to let him use his brand new car, but Pookie's daddy said, no, you're not driving my car. So we went over to Rabbit's house, and Rabbit had stole his employer's burglar alarm truck. We going to the party in a burglar alarm truck. And you know, I'm way too cool for that. How am I going to pick up this fine old girl I met in class in a burglar alarm truck? I never know. And I turned to walk away because I am too cool. And the back door of that van swung open. They had a half a gallon of Excello white pork and the biggest joint you ever saw in your life. And they said, you think you better than us. And of course I was, so I crawled on in there. And of course they didn't like my career and my information I had for them, so they started stomping on my head in the streets, and the police came, and I thought the police car was going to run me over. And in my drunken disorientation, I jumped and I landed on the hood of the police car. Oh, it has a different sound when it takes off with you on top of it. Holding on the siren, and they said, oh, that's Sonny on the car. I said, I can never be cool no more. And from that time on, I became explainer. And I'm talking about, they gave me a spiritual awakening in that alley, too. Deacon had to bail me out of his house. I lost almost sight in my left eye. And I got to thinking, how did I mess up? You know, I'm like 18, 19. How did I screw up? The job, the school? How did I mess up? That was the goal. That was something I was striving for. What happened? But every time I would rehearse that over in my mind, if I wasn't with those tramps, Mad Dog, Rabbit, and Pookie, that wouldn't have never happened. It was never the wine. So my mom and them, they took me over here because I was having some serious emotional problems. They took me to my first treatment program, Central City Mental Health Center. First day, I'm gung-ho. I want to get my psychological issues together. I recognized there was something serious wrong. You don't have to be no intellectual giant to know that you're having some serious emotional issues. Because when you come off of that alcohol, you feel restless, irritable, and discontent. And I was always restless, irritable, and discontent. I'm talking about it with just, it's just like, you know, how can I describe it? You just feel weird. Just weird and just off key. But when I hear that wine, that first drink, and it hit the pit of my stomach, I get this rush, I felt like I was on key again. But I could never hold it. I could never keep consistent. I just, boom, and then something awful would happen. So she took me over there. My mom, I'm in the room, you know, I'm having some serious problems because when you're 19, you don't have a girlfriend, and you don't have no job, and all the people, you got younger siblings doing really, really well. And, you know, it's like, you stand out. You get a lot of negative attention that way. So she took me up there and I talked to the psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist, he was a very knowledgeable man. He said, well, why do you drink so? And by that time, I had got introduced to those Anitol, Phenobarbital, Truanol, or anything at all. We called them stumble biscuits. Fender benders. See, that was the drug of the time, the flavor of the time. And I like to take them with Bourbon Deluxe. And see, I used to think 1 + 1 = 2, but it doesn't. 1 + 1 = 6. And I done OD'd off that stuff. Alcohol and barbiturates. I'm talking about just be standing there like this here and just fall like you're a tree. Bam! And they would always say, was that you fell out? I said, no, that was my twin. And so the psychiatrist, he asked me, he says, Jerome, why do you drink and drop pills like that? And I thought about it. I gave it some serious thought. I told him, I said, if I had a job and a girlfriend, I would not do that. He said, come back next week. He had a girlfriend for me. He said she was lonely and she was looking for a relationship, but she was a little bit older than I was. She looked kind of tired. I said, nah, I pass on. So I came back next week. I got that job. He got me a job. He knew some people. He knew some people with the National Alliance of Businessmen. He got me a job at International Business Machine in 1969. They was paying me to learn computers. I would work half the day in the operations office, and the other time they would send me to IBM school. I was making more money than my daddy ever made in his life. And I used to tell people, nothing, absolutely nothing, comes before my capital, J-O-B. But that wine, because see, when you drink wine and you drink like I do, on payday, you don't make it in on Monday. If you get paid on Friday at noon, you might not even make it back for the rest of the day. And so at IBM, they had this performance incentive plan. If you come to work, you get paid. And I wasn't coming to work because I was down to 75% of the time at work. And when you get down to 75% of the time at work, you don't get a raise. You have to go meet with one of the executive vice presidents of IBM. He was the Western Region Manager of IBM. He supervised all of IBM's facilities from the west of the Mississippi. And I went all the way up to the 35th floor to his office. And when I went in there, he said, have a seat, Mr. Scott. Plush office, too. Looking at, you can look out the window and see Santa Monica, the ocean. He said, Mr. Scott, I've been a manager of men for over 35 years. And I'm looking at your comments of your supervisor and your attendance record, and you have the profile. He didn't call me. He said, you have the profile of someone who has a serious problem with alcohol. And before you answer, let me tell you what this company will do. We will pay for you to go to an inpatient treatment program. You will not have to pay one dime for it. And when you get back out of treatment, I will see that you get a fresh start in this company. No one will know you have this problem but me. And if you're in any financial difficulty, I'll give you a loan that you can pay back at 10% of your pay. I looked at him, I said, I dare you insinuate. He could advise me that I have a problem with alcohol. But I got to the elevator, I went back and got the loan. Don't be no fool. And he gave me the loan. He says, I want you to know this, Mrs. Scott. If you miss another day in the next 90 days, you can come and pick up your last check. And that day came. The Rams was playing Green Bay and Green Bay for the Western Conference Championship. And I had a cold beer. It was snowing that day. And I didn't come to Tuesday, and I resigned my job. And next thing you know, I invited some people over my house, and They got all of my retirement money, stole my food, my clothing, my furniture. They cleaned me out. And they add insult to injury. They tied me upside down in the closet. And I'd probably still been there if the landlord didn't come looking for his rent. He untied me talking about, where's the rent? I said, you know, it was obvious things was on the downwards. So I just walked on out. And I walked down and I ended up on Skid Row. And I was downtown on Skid Row for the next 4 years. I'm talking about, those streets ain't no fun. Oh, it's some serious business out there. And I'm telling you, and what happened was my younger brother was getting married. He had came from college to marry his childhood sweetheart in the family church. And he told my dad that he wanted his older brother, the drunkard on Skid Row, to be his best man. So they came down to Skid Row and cleaned me up, got me a tux. But see, they had a plan. Well, my mom had a plan. Her supervisor's husband was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he had told them, don't let him drink, and I'll talk to him at the reception. So I was real thirsty. It was real tough going without drinking because I was trying to escape. And the guy got me at the reception, and he said, my name is so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic. And I relaxed. I had not been that relaxed since I had been there. Because he said he was an alcoholic. And if you're an alcoholic, you should have some alcohol. Oh yeah, I ain't no dummy. But what he did was tell me his story. That his wife, he had been sober in AA 20 years, and his wife had just gave birth to his twin daughters. And the only funds they had in the house was $6. And she gave him the $6 to go get his infant daughter some formula. And he took the $6 and went and got some wine. And out of the guilt and shame of that, drove him to AA, and he'd been sober 20 years. And I'm an intellectual, pragmatic thinker. And I thought about it. I said, well, if I get married and my wife have twin daughters and she give me $6 and I drink it up, I'll go to AA too. The deacon put me out of his house. Oh, he told me again I had to go. And now I'm terrified, and I showed up at Unit 3. That's the county hospital, psycho ward. That's not the first time I was there. It's three hots in a cot. But now I'm suicidal because I don't want to go back to the streets. And this lady psychiatrist diagnosed my problem. She said, no, I'm not going to give you a bed, even though you're suicidal. Until I see your chart. And she read this much of it, and she stopped at the county hospital. They had to find somebody to find it. And she said, Mr. Scott, your emotional problems will probably get better if you dealt with your alcoholism. And she recommended an alcoholism treatment program up at Camarillo State Hospital in 1972. That's where I attended my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting under duress. Well, not so much duress, but I had a plan. This boy meets girl on the Nut House campus and falls in love. They call it bush therapy up there. I met this cute girl. She was fine, too, and she had all her teeth. She spoke four foreign languages. She was real smart, too. And she would say, Jerry, they're going to have an AA meeting at 8:30. Let's go. And I cussed her out. But out of lust and loneliness, I went to an AA meeting. Needed some company up there. And she got out of that hospital and got a job at Tiny Nailers. And she called me up at my parents because they decided to take me in because I was doing something about my problem again. And she said, do you want to go to an AA meeting? And I had got out the day before, 90 days without a drink in the treatment program. Getting all the therapy you could get. Getting my gestalt together. All that aware. And I was drunk. And the deacon was getting ready to put me out. And she called and rescued me and took me to an AA meeting. And she said, do you want to go to 9604 South Figueroa or do you want to go to Wilshire and Normandy? I said, it didn't take me long to know where I want to go. Let's go where the high roller's at. She took me to Wilshire and Normandy. It was a huge Sunday night meeting. And but I don't want to go to the meeting. I want to go to the Starlight Motel. And we get in an argument. Well, I get in an argument with her because I'm going to bully her and make her go to the Starlight Motel because she liked me. But she was saying, I'm trying to get my daughter back, Jerome. I have to stay sober. I need these meetings. And I had heard a little something in AA, right? Little knowledge is dangerous. I had picked up on the lingo. I told her, I said, I'll be your sponsor, and you be my sponsor, and we don't need this AA stuff. And the more I got boisterous and loud right there in front of the meeting, and just like that meeting, this meeting, they had men standing at the door welcoming people in the meeting. And this little old guy, about 5'4", he heard the conversation and came and rescued this damsel in distress. And he walked up to me and looked me up and says, I'll be your damn sponsor. And then he whipped out his AA card. He says, Jack K is my name and sobriety is my game. Call anytime. I would have did something to him, but he had some friends with him. For the next 10 months, that man sponsored me because I didn't pick my sponsor. He did everything in his power to help me. And every step of the way, I rejected it. Because, see, I have the audacity to play God. That's my biggest problem. I'm always playing God. I know just what I need. Oh, I hear your advice and your direction, but in the ultimate decision, I'm going to make my decision. And it always take me get toe up. So Jack would want to come over there and hug. I said, man, look, don't hug me. You know, you're too close. So I ended up, because I never forget, Bonnie came by, and I was standing over on Kenmore, and I would walk to meetings every now and then. She came by, I was drunk and I don't know what. She had got off of work, working hard. And she came over there to see about me, and she said, you know what, Jerome? I don't think you're going to make it. Because she won't listen. And she said, I can't go down this road with you. And she got in her little hoopty and drove away, and I went back up to my other woman, Sweet Lucy. And I turned up a drink and said, so what? And I ended up back in Camarillo. That's why I'm known as the Camarillo Nut House Rethread. And it was May 1973. I had three visitors. My probation officer came to see me. Not parole. I'm not an ex-felon. I'm just a nuisance criminal. See, I got a battleship mouth and a sailboat behind. Because, see, I only drank to four states. Either I pass out, black out, fall out of my mouth, or encourage someone to knock me out. And I was on probation for a $5 bag of marijuana for 6 years. They were serious back in the day. And the weed wasn't even mine. It was my best friend. We were at the party, and he said, Pookie said, Sonny, hold my weed for me. I said, yeah, dog, I got your weed. And I put it in my shoe, and when I raised up, the LAPD was there. He saw I'm coming. He was laughing because they was taking everybody to jail. But I was not laughing because at the handcuff, you can't get down to your shoe. So I was on probation for a $5 bag of weed for 6 years. And I had this mean probation officer. He drove up to Camarillo on Mother's Day with his 90-year-old mother. He wanted to take her out for a ride. And he came up there to pay his respects and encourage me in the treatment. And he talked real nice until he got in front of his car with his mom. Oh, he just flipped on me. He said, you think you're fooling me, don't you? He said, you ain't fooling me coming to this program. Hide now. He said, if I hear you in the vicinity of a liquor store, if you get arrested for spitting on the sidewalk, or jaywalking, I'm going to make sure you go to jail for 366 days. And you will not give one day a good time. You will do every one of those days. And his little 90-year-old mother stuck her head out the window and said, good luck, young man. I want to cuss her out. I'm on my way to jail. That next week, I had my second visitor. He was a well-dressed gentleman, tall, 6'4", bulge over his heart. And I immediately knew who he was because those are skills you learn in South Central to spot the police before they spot you. And I said, there's an officer of the law. He ain't gonna want me. And he was looking for me. He went over there and asked the attendant, I'm looking for Jerome Scott. And he said, there he is, there he is. Because I was always complaining my medication wasn't on time. And he came over there and introduced himself. He said he was a special agent from the Internal Revenue Service. Shoot, I relaxed. The IRS don't put people in jail unless they have assets. He didn't have no bank accounts to compensate. And he said, you owe us $14,000. See, when I filed my income tax, I lied and told him I had 8 kids. Well, the form didn't say prove it. It says if you have 8 kids, you get all your money back. Penalties and interest. And he said, well, when you get on your feet, come and see us. I showed him my foam slippers. It says, do it look like I'm going to get on my feet? He said, gave me his card. He said, come and see us. That was on my inventory, too. I paid him. But the next visitor I had was totally unexpected. I'm sitting in there reading the Los Angeles Times business section if I had some stocks of bonds. See, I was checking to see what IBM was paying that day. Because, see, I had bought 1 share of IBM stock in the employee purchasing plan. So 4 years later, I wanted to see if it had split. But I didn't see him. There was another newcomer on that ward that had that card. Jack K is my name and sobriety is my game. Call anytime. And he called Jack Collette. And Jack got into that AA Beamer called Old Idea and drove from West Hollywood up to Camarillo to pick up this guy on the strength of a Collette call. And they were leaving. And my sponsor spotted me. And he eased behind me. I didn't see him. And he said, Jerome, what are you doing here? I didn't even turn around. I knew that voice from AA always in, you know, they got some AA members who will hound a newcomer. I'm talking about hound them. As if like they trying to collect AA babies. Hound them. He was that kind of guy. Oh, you see a newcomer, he just lit up. Oh, he just bum rush you. But see, I knew that voice because every time I come in the meeting, he rush up to me. How you doing, Jerome? I said, I had that newcomer line. I'm fine. Lying. I needed some help. Back. He asked me. I heard his voice. He says, Jerome, what are you doing here? And I said to myself, damn, he done followed me to the nut house. But he caught me off guard. See, I'm a habitual liar. I lie not for recreation. It's just one of those traits. It's the first thing come out of my mouth. Because, see, I like to play God. I don't want you to know me. And I told the truth that day. He asked me, what was I doing in Camarillo State Hospital for the second time at 25 years old? And I looked at him and I told him, I said, Jack, I don't know. I didn't know I had an illness, a deadly illness. This is not a disease. It's an illness of body, mind, and spirit. And I will always have this sickness. It cannot be cured. It can only be treated in increments of 24 hours. See, this mind of mine, this thinking, it is always out to make me think I'm God, that I can run the show and I can control it. And I'm always trying to arrange the players, and they never come off right. And he looked at me that day in the latter part of May of 1973. He says, Jerome, if you follow what I follow and you do what I do, you'll never have to drink as long as you live. And you will never have to come to a mental institution unless you choose to. He said, I got a spot for Raymond in the original 12-step men's house in Los Angeles. And I'm sure I could get you one too. Let me help you, Jerome. And see that pride swell up in me? That baseless pride? I'm not going to accept your help. I don't want your pity. I ain't nothing and I ain't going to be nothing. So why waste this time? Plus, the deacon had sent me $67. And it was Sunday. And at the Bank of Camarillo on the hospital, you can't get your money out on Sunday. You have to wait till Monday. And Jack wasn't going to wait around for me to get my $67. I had plans for it. Oh, yeah, I got that $67 that Monday. I was going. I'm on my way out. I got that $67, cashed that check at the First Bank of Camarillo with no ID because they knew where I came from. And before I got out of the town of Camarillo, I was drunk. And I arrived at the deacon's house in a blackout. And I beat him down. The only friend I had on this planet. The only one would tolerate my insanity and my madness. I beat him down. The only one would come to the jailhouses at the county jail or Wayside Honor Rancho, ride that long bus ride. Just so he would always come and ask that question. He said, I was at home and I couldn't sleep thinking of you in this place. I know you smoke and I would see you picking up butts just to smoke. So I brought you this money down here. And then he asked that $64,000 question. Why do you have to come to places like this, son? And I dropped that head because I don't know. See, I didn't know I had this illness. I was dying in ignorance. And I was going to die in ignorance. The police came and took me to jail, and I got out on an OR. Oh, it was a scene. They had bust out their windows. The police pulled up 3 carloads of them, guns drawn. And I'm out there doing that suicide by cop thing. If it was daylight, they would probably accommodate. If it was night, they probably would have accommodated me. But they had a large crowd out there. All the neighbors, my dad's neighbors, they all out there watching me bust their windows out. They choked me out, took me to jail. Got out on the OR, got drunk again, and came over there. Saw my aunt, my dad's sister, and that wine said, get her too. I chased auntie in the house. Well, auntie's not running from me. She's running to get to the bedroom where she keeps that pearl-handled, snub-nosed .38 pistol. And she had that bad boy. Cop, too. She was saying, come on in, nephew. Come right. See, the barrel of a gun does something for you, macho. I'm talking about it just zap. And you ought to see me back out of there, over the fence, down the alley in the trash can. They took me to jail again. And on that jailhouse floor on the 5th of June, 1973, I had a spiritual awakening in a drunken stupor. It dawned on me that everybody was trying to help me but me. And if I was going to do any recovering, I was going to have a hand in it. And I made a commitment, not to God, to anybody that day. I made a commitment that I would do anything that man asked me to do. I said, if I could get off this floor and get back with Jack, I will do anything he asked me to do. If he asked me to jump, I'm going to ask him how high. And he never asked me to jump too high. I can't tell you what this problem of having a sponsor that's built on merited trust that you're able to connect with for 36 years. 36 years until he died, he was my sponsor. And I never took a journey and did anything unless he knew about it. No, he wasn't running my... Oh, one time when I got married to my present wife, I didn't tell him. But I called him back. He had went to work, so that don't count. But I could tell you, he literally took that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and he took me through it. Because I didn't have no place to go that first night of my sobriety. I'm going to walk back down the skid row. My resolve and my commitment was gone. And I got almost to skid row. at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, in a still, quiet voice, say, "Son, if you go down the Skid Row, you go down the Skid Row to die, and you won't be coming back this time." And I don't know if I have the kind of love my dad had for me. After what I had done to him and how I had treated him and stole and lied to him, I knocked on his door at 3 o'clock in the morning and I asked him, and he said, "What you want?" I said, "Dad, will you please just help me one more time? Because I think I found a way not to drink." And that man loved his son just enough to forgive him for all of his dastardly treatment. He said, "Go back there and lay down. But if you drink, son, please leave." And I started making these meetings. I can't tell you that. I can't tell you the past 40 years what has happened. It's beyond belief. Not a has been, but a never was. My sponsor, he took me through the book. And I'm so glad he took me through the book. Because sometimes when you read the book by yourself, it's kind of not clear. Yeah, it's a self-help program, but it's not a do-it-yourself self-help program. Because he asked me one day, I was about 6 months old, he said, "Jerome, what is the first step in recovery?" And I rattled off, we admitted we were powerless over. He said, "No, Jerome, that's not the first step in recovery." He said, "The first step in recovery is in chapter 3. We learned to concede to our innermost selves that we are bodily and mentally different." I'm bodily and mentally different. I can't change that fact. My body is different. And the reaction of alcohol on my body, it activates a subtle compulsion that makes it virtually impossible for me to stop. And I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, at 40 years of sobriety, I could never be too sober where I can't get drunk. Sobriety and length of sobriety is not what saves me. What saves me is what Bill Wilson talks about. If I fail to enlarge my spiritual life, I will not be able to endure the low spots to come. And there are going to be some low spots. It ain't no straight up the hill type of recovery. Oh, there are going to be some tough things you're going to have to deal with, Jay. And he talked about the doctor's opinion a lot, too. Because, see, if I don't have an entire psychic change and I keep making a partial change, I'm going to go back. See, that's what sobriety is. That's why he said the man who thinks sobriety is enough is not thinking. It's not. And for me, there was a long road of reconstruction ahead. And I could not say, "I'm sorry, Dad." It wouldn't fit the bill. And what happened was, you know, when Dr. Silkworth talks about that, men and women essentially like alcohol because they like the effects produced by alcohol. Although it is injurious, after a time they can't differentiate the true from the false. They are restless, irritable, and discontent. Unless they can feel a sense of ease and comfort which comes from taking a few drinks. And after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, the phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through a well-known stage of a spree, a binge, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to do it again. This is repeated over and over. Unless this person has an entire psychic change, there's very little hope for his recovery. And it's almost hopeless because, see, I can't do that on my own. And he says, on the other hand, as strange as it may seem to those that don't understand that once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, that they had so many problems, they despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds they can easily control their desire to drink. The only thing required is they follow a simple, few simple rules. But then he don't tell you the rules. They don't mention the rules. He shares his experience. But my wife heard this guy named Peter F. He's deceased now from San Diego. And he talked about the rules. And when she told me about the rules, I set up. I said, I've been trying to find out what those rules are, and I just can't. And she said, and I know we have a lot of new friends in here. I think if you adhere to the six essential rules of recovery, you will build a foundation that is unshakable. And it doesn't take a long time, because it didn't take Bill Wilson a long time. Bill Wilson got sober November of 1934. And before he was, 30 days, he was carrying the message, wasn't he? Yeah, he was out there working this thing. But the six rules. I'm going to say this and shut up because I'm about almost through, right, baby? Oh, okay. I got my speaker channel. 10 minutes? Okay. There's six essential rules. The first rule is you have to have a sobriety day. Because you can't begin this psychic change slipping and dipping and tripping. You have to stop. You have to stop. And see, that sobriety day is a spiritual day. It's a spiritual date of rebirth. See, my sobriety date is June 6, 1973. Nothing is equal to that day. Nothing is above that day. You can take everything I got, but you can't have that day. I'm not going to give that date up for nothing. For love, money, property, prestige, no. Oh, I will hurt, but I'm not giving that date up. No, I might not look good going through it, but I'm not going to give that date up. Because, see, sometimes we get into, I got to look good. Nah, I've been tore up from the floor up here in AA. It's all right. I just come and look tore up because I know I'm coming back. Because that leads me to that second rule. You have to have a viable home group. Oh, if your home group is not the best home group on the planet, you better go find one. See, my home group is the Bellflower Bigfoot group. See, Jack died, so I had to get me a new sponsor. And it's kind of difficult, too. It ain't no easy task. If you've been talking to somebody for 36 years, every day, and now all of a sudden, they dead? It's like, spiritually, I was off key. I was just off key everywhere. Because I'm wondering, I say, where's my help? Oh, I'm going to meetings. So I had always had my eye on this guy, but I had my eye on him for the wrong reason. I said, well, I asked him to be my sponsor so I can keep an eye on my wife at the Bellflower Bigfoot group. That wouldn't work. So I have a home group, a sponsor in the Bellflower Bigfoot group. And my sponsor's job is to take me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what is a sponsor? It's an acronym, really. Sober People Offering Newcomers Solutions on Recovery. So I have a whole lot of sponsors in my home group. I call them surrogate sponsors. Oh, yeah. You know, my sponsor's not available 24/7. And some of my sober brothers, they have the authority to correct me and teach me. I just don't have one person, so my home group is really important because I never know where I'm going to run into one of them. You know, I might be driving on the freeway somewhere. I heard somebody say with their sticker on or whatever. So I got a home group and a sponsor. That sponsor took me through the steps. That's the third rule. The fourth rule is going through the steps. The fifth rule will ensure you won't drink when all other activities fail. That's intense work with another alcoholic. But I didn't think the sixth rule was possible. I didn't think it would be a reality in my experience. But the sixth rule is you get to insist on enjoying life, facing life on life's terms, not ducking or dodging any of life's issues, walking in your own personal brand of dignity, and not making any excuses for your existence. And my sponsor made me, well, he didn't make me, but he guided and directed me. I just said this and shut up real quick. I was working at this government agency, the post office, for what, 21 years. And they came in and downsized the whole job. Told me your job is gone. If you don't have a job by Friday, you're out of the door. And I was angry. And my supervisor came the day before that I'm getting ready to get bounced because I hadn't got a job. And she said, I saved your job, Jerome, if you be willing to go back to school and get a master's. And I asked her, I said, is the post office going to pay for it? She said, no. And I told her, I'm not going. She said, well, clear out your desk tomorrow at 5:30. I said, hold it, let me go talk to my sponsor. And I called Jack, all in distress. I say, Jack, these people are crazy. They won't give me my severance pay all at once. They're going to dole it out to me like I'm a tramp. And now they want me to go to school and get a master's degree. They won't even pay for it. I say, Jack, by the time I get a master's degree, I'll be 50 years old. And he said, well, look at it like this, Jay. If you live to be 50, you'll be 50 without a master's. Go ahead and go. So I took his advice. One more time. Got that master's, almost got my license, and on the 13th of 2007, September, I said, I see you people. Was able to walk out the door. Doing good, too. And I want to thank Mike for asking me. I done ran over my time. I don't know where I was going with that. But if we have any new friends, please stick to this program. Hang in there. Do the six rules. Thank you.